The first mystery is this. Why did Frank Lloyd Wright, a committed champion of domestic virtues and a driven artist on the very cusp of achieving his lifelong professional ambition, desert his wife, Catherine, and their six children in 1909, and again in 1911, to run off with Mema Cheney, thereby crippling both marriage and career at a single blow? And the second mystery, inexplicably bound up with the first, why, on a blazing summer afternoon 5 years later, in a frenzy of blood and fire, did Julian Carleton take away everything Wright had left?
In August 1914, high art and some elemental force came together to produce multiple murders at Taliesin. How did it happen? Why did it happen? What were the consequences for Frank Lloyd Wright and the course of modern architecture? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
By 1914, Frank Lloyd Wright was probably the world's most famous architect. What effect did he create with his own home, Taliesin, in the hills near Spring Green, Wisconsin? How did that particular home come to be the site of so much trauma and tragedy? What makes the story behind the events of a hot summer day more than just a horrific murder mystery? Our guest is William Drennan, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Baraboo and author of Death in a Prairie House, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin Murders, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2007.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
I really enjoyed your book, but I have to say it's a very brutal, grisly story, and I would have to ask, as an English professor, what is a good English professor like yourself doing writing a book about Frank Lloyd Wright and these murders, this sensational, scandal-ridden, brutal murder?
Yeah, what a natural and inevitable question, one that I'm hard-pressed to answer. And I looked at the back cover of my own book, and I see that it's cross-listed as biography slash architecture slash true crime.
Emphasis on slash.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. What I tell my own writing students is that research of any kind mimics a detective story, or at least an act of detection, and it's enough to follow a spoor if you find it interesting. In my graduate school days, when I was a lowly dissertator, I found it sufficiently interesting to think thoughts about Machiavelli's influence on Fulk Greville, a remarkably obscure 16th, 17th century English poet playwright. And that was interesting to me then, and remains so now. But as far away from my own discipline as the events at Taliesin in 1914 might seem at first blush, they do carry with them the same mandate of literary studies, namely to try to get things right, try to understand things more truly, and communicate that insight to a larger audience.
And this story is one that is, I was going to say, not frequently told, is hardly told at all.
Yeah, that's another point, I suppose. It really is an unduly neglected tidbit of history, it seems to me. Frank Lloyd Wright is the most written about artistic figure in the West since Michelangelo. He has legions, he has battalions of biographers and commentators. All of them seem largely to ignore the murders at Taliesin on August 15, 1914. One of Wright's most reliable and chief biographers dismisses the whole event in one paragraph. Most biographers, in fact, seemed anxious to get beyond that to the great glories that are to follow, the Guggenheim and the Imperial Hotel and Falling Water and so on, and to ignore what certainly for the victims was a pivotal day in their lives, and one cannot but think that it was true for Frank Lloyd Wright as well. You mentioned in your introductory remarks, how does this crime transcend the mere unhappy calculus of body count? This was not just another murder, I would argue. These crimes involved, arguably, the country's most celebrated architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. That was certainly true of him subsequently. It involved Taliesin, which is arguably the most impressive and important residential design in the country of the 20th century. It involves Wright's paramour, his lover, Mema Borthwick Cheney, who was kind of proto-feminist, the country's leading spokesperson for the thought of Ellen Kay, a Swedish proto-feminist who argued long and loudly for such concepts as free love. It involves an impact on Wright's subsequent residential design.
You raised the point in your introduction that Wisconsin has a rather bad history in terms of serial killers, and that this story also fits into a picture of Wisconsin.
I don't think I wanted to imply quite that much, but we are unhappily, of course, the home state of folks like Ed Gein and Jeff Dahmer. I think their crimes, however, are mostly interesting on a purely forensic or criminological sort of level. The crimes of Taliesin, again, seem to me to transcend all of this. I think they had an impact on social history as opposed merely to popular history.
Frank Lloyd Wright did come from rural backgrounds, and of course Taliesin celebrates that rural setting. How did he come to Taliesin? Let's bring him up to that point in his career.
Sure. He said he built Taliesin as a wall, as a fortress, a place where he could fight the fight that he saw he needed to. He had been born in Richland Center. Richland Center's city motto is from farming to Frank Lloyd Wright. He was born, unfortunately, in a house that was so architecturally undistinguished that it was shortly after razed and torn down. His father, William Carey Wright, was an itinerant preacher, originally a Baptist preacher, latterly a Unitarian one. The family was constantly on the move. He ended up in Madison, went to high school here, claimed to have graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, did not, in fact, seems to have attended about 1 year, where he studied not so much architecture as engineering. He then went off to Chicago. At this point, he's hardly more than a Wisconsin farm boy with a knack for design, but he's also a man of enormous ambition and enormous skill. And within a short time, he left Wisconsin with $7 in his pocket. He lands in Chicago. He immediately spends $3 or $4 of those dollars to see a concert. He's always drawn to such things. But he becomes the highest paid architectural draftsman in the metropolis in Chicago within a short time. He connects himself with Sullivan and Adler's firm. He becomes a bright light, an emerging star among the younger Chicago architects. He breaks with Sullivan and Adler at a later date, probably because he was moonlighting residential designs against his contractual obligations to that firm. And he builds a house for himself in a western suburb, Oak Park, marries a lovely young woman named Catherine, begins to settle down, and begins to produce children. One of his neighbors said that if the man has any more children, he's going to overrun this town. He, or more specifically Catherine, had in fact 6. And more to the point, he becomes an ardent champion of, I suppose, what we would call in these latter days family values. He becomes an ardent disciple of domesticity. It becomes a kind of substitute religion for him. He draws upon Emerson and Thoreau and Whitman and the New England Transcendentalist, and before them the early English and German romantics of the early 19th century, and comes to the conclusion that the holiest thing in life is, in fact, the home. He quotes approvingly in a book that he published at his own expense. The book itself, the text of the book, is constituted by a sermon on the topic given by an Oak Park minister. But Wright writes, "I dreamed of paradise, and still, though sun lay soft on vale and hill, and trees were green and rivers bright, the one dear thing that made delight by sun or stars or Eden weather was just that we two were together." Well,
we two becomes we eight, and you're trying to come up with some designs. How did that play out?
That was a problem for him.
And you also talk about his parents, not a very happy domestic model there.
There's an implicit irony in a man who champions domesticity so much that he makes the so-called coaxial design the centerpiece of his residential architecture. That is, the hearth, the emblem of domesticity, becoming the center of the household plan. For such a man one day to run off with a neighbor lady and desert his wife and 6 kids, yes, it strikes us as perhaps jarring, as I'm sure it did for Catherine and the kids. I think increasingly, as we move toward, say, 1909, he finds, for the first time, suburban life to be becoming increasingly restrictive and constrictive. I think he feels that it is not a place that gives ample opportunity for the free expression of the imperial self. especially the imperial self of a self-described genius. And probably if anyone deserves that appellation, it was Wright. He built the rookery. He built a studio in his house. He'd try to alienate himself, or at least barricade himself against his ever-growing brood. But, of course, it didn't work. The kids found their way out. He complained that everywhere, every day, something was smashing, something was breaking.
You write that he didn't like being called Papa either.
He didn't like being called Papa. He recoiled from that term of paternal endearment. I'm not certain why. He consistently, in his own writings and in his own talk, speaks of his buildings as his children. And latterly, he emphasizes and urges the notion that for Catherine, his wife, the children were everything. For him, his buildings were everything, and in fact constituted, in a metaphoric sense, his children.
Well, let's talk about that neighbor lady that he runs off with.
Mamie Borthwick Cheney. Interesting woman. Her father was a railroad man. He started off kind of on the bottom rung, but worked his way up the ladder with Chicago and Northwestern and finally became foreman of their repair shop. And he was making enough money that he could move his family to the rather opulent, still is, of course, western suburb of Chicago, Oak Park. That's where Mamie grew up. She went off to the University of Michigan, where she was wooed by mild-mannered Edwin Cheney. She seemed reluctant about the match. In fact, she kept putting him off, but that did not dissuade loyal, dogged Edwin, who continued to pursue her. She graduated from the University of Michigan, went off to Port Huron, Tommy Edison's hometown, and served as a librarian for 5 years. And finally, back in Oak Park, when her mother died and her father died, I get the sense she said to Edwin, okay, I'll marry you. But I'll marry you on this stipulation, namely that we live in Oak Park. And he said, okay. They honeymooned on the continent, came back. She became pregnant with their son. And quite naturally, they cast about for a house. And they said, let's find an architect. And the suggestion was made, well, you know, we have this local man, Wright. The next thing anyone knew, Wright and Mamie Cheney were blasting around Oak Park in Wright's bright yellow Dayton Stoddard sports car called the Yellow Devil. And tongues began to wag. And indeed, by 1909, Wright and Mamie left their respective families. She had two children by that time. Went off to Europe, first to Germany, then to Italy. Wright apparently, but inauthentically, contrite, returned to home and hearth in 1911, only to get some affairs in order, and then again fled back to Mamie in Europe.
How is he financing all of this travel?
There's a tangled web indeed, Norman. That's, I suppose, legions of accountants could pore over Frank Lloyd Wright's lifetime of financial dealings and remain completely stumped. He financed such jaunts in a variety of ways. He was a great collector of Japanese prints, for example, and he would buy those and sell those. He would sell partial mortgages on a variety of houses, partial equity in the mortgages of a variety of property, and create legal tangles that essentially became insoluble, Gordian knots. And, of course, at the time, he was, in his own way, a successful architect. There were commissions coming in. Oak Park can be looked at as a kind of living museum of Frank Lloyd Wright's designs. His neighbors might have had complaints about his lifestyle or about the number of children he had produced or about his extramarital affair with Mamie Cheney, but they could not deny the fact that the houses he was building for them were wonders.
When he decides to build Taliesin, the Spring Green neighbors are not so happy when they learn the true purpose. Can you talk about that?
Not so happy, yeah. He had been duplicitous about the matter. He writes in a letter to essentially the man who became his banker, Darwin Martin, a wealthy industrialist, ran a soap factory, that he really sought to see about building a farm up country, he said, for his mother. Well, that farm up country, of course, becomes finally Taliesin, and it's not really intended for his mother at all. It's intended for Frank and Mamie, again, to get their backs up against the wall and to fight for that which Frank saw them as needing to fight. But you're right. To bring such a household into bucolic spring green right across the Wisconsin River prompted some predictable outcries. Sermons were preached. There was some talk about a forcible eviction. There was some talk about a tarring and feathering.
What about the layout? I realize it's a complicated subject, but what about the layout of Taliesin reflected Wright's philosophy at this point? I mean, he's obviously gotten a little bit past this glorifier of the nuclear family.
Yeah, he has. And Taliesin, for the first time, the coaxial center of the design is no longer the hearth. It is rather the living room. And at Taliesin, it's a place where if one stands and casts about and looks through the windows at the countryside about, one gets a sense of almost being suspended in air. The architectural argument going on here implicitly seems to be something along the lines of here at last is a place where the individual will be unfettered. It is, however, in many ways the apotheosis, the culmination, the perfection, if you will, the distilled essence of organic architecture as Wright saw it. That is to say, it is made out of materials that are indigenous to the area, the masonry, even the coloring, the timbers, all local stuff. It is distinctly horizontal. It is set into, not on top of a hill. Taliesin translates from the Welsh as shining brow, referring at once to this hill and on which the house sits, and I suspect to the architect as well, because Taliesin was also a kind of bardic god in Celtic mythology, one who was able to shake the world.
And it's such a beautiful setting for such a horrible event that's going to take place in August of 1914. We're going to delve into the murders when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, visit wpr.org/underwriting.
Wright's success was grounded in his grand conception of the Prairie House specifically and of what he called organic architecture generally. Not that the ideas were entirely original with Wright. As early as the 1840s, while his grandfather, Richard Lloyd Jones, was still leading his family on their arduous trek halfway across the continent, the American sculptor Horatio Greenough was writing a letter to Ralph Waldo Emerson in which he says, "Here is my theory of architecture, a scientific arrangement of spaces and forms to function and to sight, color and ornament to be decided and arranged and varied by strictly organic laws, having a distinct reason for each decision, the entire and immediate banishment of all makeshift and make-believe."
A description of that Prairie School of Architecture and some of the inspiration behind it. For Frank Lloyd Wright, I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, William Drennan, who is the author of Death in a Prairie House, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin Murders. We've gotten Taliesin built. It's August of 1914. It's already a scandalous place before I guess anybody has even quite moved in. What is our cast of characters?
We have in residence at Taliesin in August of 1914, we have Mamah Borthwick Cheney, Wright's lover. She's about 45 years old at the time. Her son, John, 12. Her daughter, Martha, 8, was due to be 9 the next week. And then a series of draftsmen and handymen and apprentices, Emile Brodel, about 30 years old, about to be married. Like Wright, he had been born in Richland Center, although he saw Milwaukee as his home at the time. A wonderful draftsman, had drawn the aerial views for Taliesin and for the Midway Gardens in Chicago and for the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. Thomas Brunker, age about 66, from Ridgeway, general foreman and laborer and handyman around the place. Ernest Weston, 13 years old, an assistant carpenter, the son of Billy Weston, who was also there, a wonderful, wonderful carpenter who physically built much of Taliesin. Wright held Weston in high esteem. He said he was one of those, quote, good mechanics who show up from time to time in the country. And he admired the way that Billy Weston drove home nails with inerrant strokes of his handmade hammer. David Lindblom was there, about 45 or 48, depending on which source you credit. He was a landscape architect and gardener. Herbert Fritz, in his early 20s, was a draftsman. And then there were the two fairly newly hired servants. They had been hired in mid-June from Chicago on a recommendation from the Vogelzang family, a family of restaurateurs and caterers who, in fact, were caterers for the Midway Gardens project. Julian Carlton and his wife Gertrude, an African-American couple, both right about 30. Gertrude was serving as a maid and cook at Taliesin, Julian as a kind of butler come handyman around the place.
And this doesn't seem to be one of those whodunits. In other words, you make it pretty clear that everyone agrees that it was Julian Carlton, although there are occasional other theories floating about.
Sure, yeah. I guess it's more of a how-done-it in some ways.
And certainly a why-done-it.
Yeah. There seems to be no doubt at all, or any fair doubt, although that was not always the case, as I stipulate in the book, that Julian Carlton was the sole murderer and thereby gained the unhappy distinction of being the greatest mass murderer in Wisconsin 20th century history.
Premeditated.
There's ample evidence that it was. Some of it's shrouded in mystery. We know, for example, a couple of weeks before the murders, that he told his wife Gertrude that he had to go down to Madison to get some dental work done. In fact, she later got a telegraph from him from Chicago. She claimed to the police later on that she had no idea what her husband was doing in Chicago, nor did he later confide in her. He returns to Taliesin at about the same time as Mamie Borthwick Cheney's children arrive there, having been pawned off on her for their summer vacation at a place they actually didn't like much.
Well, before we get into his personality and also the effect of race in general on how this case was reported, can you take us through the day itself, August 15th, 1914? What is it that happened?
Yeah. The custom of the family, the custom of the house, was for the family to take their meals in one location in Taliesin and for the workmen and apprentices to take their meals somewhere else. The best I can figure from existing blueprints, about 80 feet away. The family took their meals on this particular day, and we're talking about lunch, high noon on August 15th, 1914, on a breezeway. Visitors to the most recent avatar of Taliesin, Taliesin 3 as it's sometimes called, Taliesin East as it's called by others, may well have been out on that bird walk that is appended to the place. This is about the location of a screened-in porch in 1914 in the first conception of Taliesin. And this is where Mamie and her two children sat down to lunch on that day, no doubt in an attempt to escape the heat. Also, it afforded a beautiful view of the Wisconsin River and a man-made pool that Wright had made. The servants, the handyman, the draftsmen, architectural draftsmen, took their meals at the far western end of the residence. What seems to have happened is this, and my own interpretation of the mere logistics of the crime vary a good deal from the received tradition. My own conception of what happens is that Julian Carlton serves soup first to the family, to Mamie and to the children, and then, frankly, drives a hatchet of a type called a shingling hatchet deep into the head of Mamie Borthwick, essentially splitting her skull in two. He then instantly dispatches her young son, John, 12. In fact, there was so little left of John after the fire and murder that a death certificate was never issued in his name. He seems then to have chased down Mamie's daughter, Martha, and killed her in the courtyard of the place. I think that he then went over to the workmen's quarters to a room about 12 feet by 12 feet that originally had been intended, nominally at least, as a living quarters for Anna Lloyd Wright, Frank's mother, but forced into use as a dining room for the workmen. He served the men their soup. He locked the only door to the place from the outside. He poured gasoline under the door. Gasoline seeped in, floated over, streamed over the floor of the dining room, unremarked by the men for a moment. And then Carlton outside, shingling hatchet in hand, lit his pipe, threw down the match into the gasoline, and instantly that room became filled with fire, and the men rose as one, essentially living torches and horribly burned.
One question that comes to mind here, though, Carlton has served lunch to Mamie and her children. He has killed two of them on the spot, chased the third one down and killed her.
Right.
And then, without anybody knowing the difference, even from a distance of 80 feet, he's going to go over and calmly serve soup to some draftsmen and then go through locking the door and pouring in the gas without anybody being at all suspicious?
You would think somebody would have noticed. Yeah. As I confess in the book, are there problems with even this revised chronology of what occurred? And frankly, there are. And one of them, of course, you've touched upon. If, in fact, he had to chase down Martha Cheney there in the courtyard and hatchet her to death, hitting her some four times in the head, on a hot summer day, when we must assume that windows were open and that solid doors were open and so on, how come nobody noticed? Well, a couple of answers suggest themselves. We'll never know for certain, but it's quite possible that Martha was stunned into mute silence given the horror of what she had just witnessed. It's possible as well that the murder didn't occur there. Her murder didn't occur there specifically. One of the first outsiders to arrive at Taliesin after the crimes was a farm laborer named Jake Ferris, and his testimony was that he found the girl still wandering around in that loggia, in that central outdoor section of Taliesin, her clothes still aflame. So it's hard to know exactly what happened there in connection with Martha, when precisely she died. The difficulty with coming up with an alternative to the reconstruction that I've posited here, however tentatively, is that there doesn't seem to be any other way to explain how one man kills so many so quickly. And the matter of motive also has a role to play, as does the element of time. The received orthodox view of the murders is that he first sets fire to the room in which the workmen are dining. He then runs some 80 feet away, not 25 feet as was reported by contemporary news accounts, dispatches Mamie, dispatches John, chases down Martha and kills her, and then and only then returns to where the workmen were, stands with his hatchet at the ready by the door, expecting them to attempt to escape there, as in fact a majority of them did, sees that a couple of the workers, Herb Fritz and Emil Brodel, are trying to escape through a back window, runs around the house, kills Brodel, just misses killing Fritz, then runs around again to the front of the house and begins killing the men as the remaining men, as they break down the door and try to make their way to safety. There simply isn't enough time for all of that to have happened. By my reckoning, something like 60 seconds, and no, that's not enough time. In his sworn testimony to the Chicago Tribune on the day after the murder, one of those survivors, Herb Fritz, said that as soon as Julian left serving them their meal, that gasoline began pouring under the door. And in fact, he didn't have time, that's to say, Herb Fritz didn't have time to remark the fact, in his words, to his fellow diners that there was gasoline in the room before the explosion occurred.
Now, there's one person we haven't accounted for yet, though, and that is Carlton's wife. What's she doing when all this happens?
Gertrude is basically getting out of Dodge as fast as she can. She testified later to police that she saw her husband throw down a match into the flame, that he had for days been threatening to kill people around the house, that he had been sleeping with the hatchet either under his pillow or under his bed. And when she started to see the slaughter commence, she paused for a moment, for reasons we'll never know, to put on her very best hat and then tried to escape the house, found a door block that she hoped to use, and went through a window and started running down the road toward Spring Green. She was found there by some motorists later on, hiding in a bush, was brought into Spring Green, spent the night there of the 14th in lockup, and then was taken to Dodgeville in Iowa County, where she remained in jail for 2 or 3 weeks, but finally was just let go, primarily, according to contemporary news accounts, on matters of thrift. They thought it was costing too much to hold her, and that she'd said everything she had to say that was potentially useful to the prosecution of the case.
And
once she gets on that train and goes back to Chicago, we never see her again.
And as you were looking at this story and these characters, did her personality and the circumstances surrounding her leave troubling doubts in your mind, or are you convinced she was simply... I mean, it sounds as if earlier she had been a battered wife by this man, or certainly a suffering wife. But did you have any sense that she might have had a hand in any way in what happened?
No, none at all. And I wish in some ways that she had. The logistics of the crime, as Norman's question earlier suggested, would be infinitely less complicated.
If there were two people involved.
If Carlton had an accomplice, namely his wife, there's no evidence of that at all. She seems, as you say, from subsequent testimony of her neighbors in Chicago, in two different African-American neighborhoods in Chicago, to have lived in great fear of Julian and indeed to have suffered a good deal of physical abuse at his hands from time to time.
We have 7 victims total, but not all die immediately, and those survivors are really the key to identifying Carlton as the one and only perpetrator.
Yeah, but even some who didn't die on the spot, and indeed, and this is a troubling sort of matter, there, it can be argued that almost nobody was dead on the spot at the point that Julian Carlton thought they were. Mama was certainly dead. John was certainly dead. The others, including Martha, including Emil Brodel, although he was probably dead, although not certainly so. One early arriver at Taliesin claims that he was still on his hands and knees and only then collapsed. Tom Brunker was probably still alive. Little 13-year-old Ernie Weston was still alive. So was David Lindblom. In their deathbed testimony, men like the Ridgeway handyman, Tom Brunker, said, yeah, it was Julian, and it was only Julian. And that seems to have been the universal testimony of both the survivors and the dying.
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright was away from home at the time, and we're going to talk about his reaction to the murders and also some of the supposed reasons that they occurred when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
As for Frank, he was devastated. Like Job, he broke out in boils. He took to sleeping on a cot in the back of a studio workshop. During the fire, his piano had been thrown out of the living room and onto the lawn. Its legs had broken off in the fall, but Wright had the instrument propped up on top of the studio vault. And, like his father before him, he thundered away at its keys from time to time. Then he would pace restlessly or would ride his horse to some high ridge and stare hollow-eyed down into the ruined valley below. Years later, he wrote, "After the first terrible anguish, a kind of black despair seemed to paralyze my imagination in Mama's direction and numbed my sensibilities. The blow was too severe. I got no relief in any faith, nor yet in any hope."
the reaction of Frank Lloyd Wright to a series of brutal murders in 1914. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is William Drennan, who was reading from his recent book, Death in a Prairie House, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin Murders. We established how these seven brutal murders took place, and also the murderer. Let's talk about where Frank Lloyd Wright was at the time that this occurred. He lost in this fatal day on August 15th, 1914. He lost his mistress, Mama, two of her children, and a group of handymen and
dear friends.
And,
yeah. Yes, yes. It's true. Yeah, Wright had left 3 or 4 days before to go to Midway Gardens to put the finishing touches on that place, which was already very strapped for cash. He and his son John, who had joined him in a kind of partnership, were working round the clock, trying to get the place ready to open. A call came in to Frank from actually a Madison man who gave him the first inkling that something terrible had gone wrong at Taliesin, that the place was on fire and that people were dead. He wandered into the room where his son John was high up on a ladder, sandwich in one hand, paintbrush in the other. He was at work on a polychromatic mural for the place. And John reported later that a horrible silence just suddenly filled the room, and he looked down at his father, who was understandably ashen and was leaning up against a table, and asked his son to summon a taxi, that something awful had happened at Taliesin. He got in a taxi. He got his lawyer, Sherman Booth, to join him and son John, and off they went to the railroad station, where they found that the only train back to Lonesome Spring Green was a slow milk route that would take most of the night. To make matters worse, standing there on the platform was Edwin Cheney, waiting for the same train that would take him to the place where his wife and children lay dead.
Cheney already knew then, or was this a coincidence?
Cheney seems to have been informed in some way, yeah, that has been lost to us.
So you have Frank Lloyd Wright standing next to the man.
Not only standing next to the man, but oddly enough, walking up and shaking his hands, and that hand was accepted. Further, when news by this time had begun to filter its way into the city, and reporters began to, and curiosity seekers began to descend upon the railroad platform, son John forced his father and Edwin Cheney into a small compartment together. And they got in there, and the train chugged off for Spring Green. John, for some reason, later in his own biography of his father, says that he found it surprising that Frank and Edwin said nothing to each other during that long, slow, torturous journey. Perhaps we understand why better than his son did.
How did others converge on Taliesin? How far was it from the nearest house, and how quickly did others come in to what they found there?
Pretty quickly. Immediately after the murders, Julian Carleton, no doubt under the assumption that everyone was dead, as we've seen, in fact, not quite everyone was, went off and hid in the boiler or fire pot of the basement of the place. He seems to have carried the hatchet with him. He carried with him also a bottle of muriatic or hydrochloric acid that he had bought a week before from a pharmacy in Spring Green. The first to rouse himself was Billy Weston, Wright's favorite, the carpenter. And he got hold of another one who had survived the initial onslaught, although he later succumbed to his injuries, David Lindblom, the gardener or landscaper. And off they ran to the Reeder place, which was a farm a good ways off. That was a long run through the Iowa County cornfields. Reeder, they knew, had a telephone, and they got word out. And word spread quickly from person to person. And very soon, neighboring farmers came from their fields, from their houses. Townspeople came. The folks from the Hillside Hill School, which Frank Lloyd Wright had built for his sisters, the aunts, descended upon the place as well. His uncle at Tower Hill Assembly, Reverend Jenkin Lloyd Jones, Civil War veteran, came riding up as well and bringing with him a host of people. By the time it was mid-afternoon, I suppose, it's estimated that about 700 people had descended upon the place. And when we consider that the population of Spring Green in those days was about 750, this was a pretty good crowd.
And what happened then to take Julian Carleton into custody?
Nobody could find him for a long time. It seems, in fact, that there was a good deal of fear that He had Confederates, probably African-American Confederates, who were hiding out in the nearby woods. This was much feared for a long time, completely unsubstantiated. But nobody could find him, and men began to form themselves rather naturally into impromptu groups. There was a fire brigade to address themselves to the conflagration. And there were a lot of posses who were beating the fields and looking all around Taliesin trying to find Julian. He was finally located in the fire pot of the building, at which point apparently he finished off, drank off the bottle of muriatic acid. The Iowa County Sheriff then came in, and Sheriff Williams, and made the arrest. He had a difficult time getting Julian Carleton out of the place. The mood of the crowd was changing, and what had been a bucket brigade was quickly turning into a potential lynch mob. This was especially true of some men from Ridgeway, the town where Tom Brunker was from. And men were looking to their rifles, men were looking to ropes. So Sheriff Williams had Carleton, had a car brought around to the back of the place. Carleton forced through a window in the basement into the car. Williams joined him. They drove off, found themselves blocked by three cars of filled with would-be Ridgeway vigilantes. Williams leveled his gun at the trio of cars. They finally made way for him, although apparently pursued him for some way down the road and due south toward Dodgeville, where Carleton was imprisoned and lived, in fact, for some 7.5 weeks before finally succumbing to the injuries associated with having drunk the poison.
And if we look into his motives, besides simply having a history of violence in the past, a history of kind of, you talk about his wild fits that had been reported earlier. What do we know about his time at Taliesin and his attitude toward the people that he killed and the extent to which race played a factor?
Yeah, I think race did play a factor. Not to play that card too facilely, but we need to remember that Julian and his wife were the only two African-American folks for miles and miles and miles around, found themselves very isolated. Julian, who had demonstrated definite signs of paranoia and severe emotional difficulties even in the city, quickly became disenchanted with the place. He started using his wife very early on as a kind of cat's paw, a kind of ambassador to Mema in an effort to get out of there. He wanted his wife Gertrude to say that she was, quote, lonesome, that she was homesick, that she wanted to get back to Chicago. It seems actually to have been Julian who didn't like living in Spring Green and wanted to get out. So you have this extremely volatile and potentially paranoid personality type on the one hand, and then you isolate him in rural Spring Green. Then, given the endemic racism of the day, as might be expected, unfortunately, the man seems to have been subjected to a fair share of racial epithets, especially from one individual, and that was Emil Brodel, that 30-year-old draftsman for Frank Lloyd Wright. We know that there had been fisticuffs between the two. We know that there had been a racial expletive used in Julian's direction from the lips of Emil Brodel. And my deepest suspicion is that the primary motive behind the murders at Taliesin, insofar as any such horror can be rationally explained away, is that Julian Carleton wanted Emil Brodel dead, and he didn't want anyone else around to tell the story of how he came to be dead.
And what became of Julian Carleton after drinking muriatic acid?
It was long thought that nothing much happened, that he just wasted away, that he didn't eat anything, that he didn't say anything. He weighed about 95 pounds at the time of his death, and that he was then simply carted off, about which more later. In fact, I was able to find in Scottsdale, Arizona, something of the Rosetta Stone of such inquiries, namely the long-thought-lost transcripts of jail records and court hearings and appearances attached to the case. It was long thought that these either did not exist or, if they existed, had been long lost. I searched for over a year trying to find the things. I went to the Iowa County Courthouse, and where I was told that, no, those records, if there had been any, had been sent out years and years ago when Iowa County divested itself of such printed material. Half of it had been sent, I was told, to the Carmen Library on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, the other half to the Historical Society at UW-Madison. Went to both those places. The records weren't there. Went to historical societies and so on. Couldn't find them anywhere. Finally, in not a sentence, not a paragraph, not a chapter, but a footnote to one of the texts I was consulting. I found a reference to the fact that one William Marlin was compiling the official Taliesin-approved biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, and that he had found the records. So I investigated into Marlin, but discovered, unfortunately, he had passed away before he could complete his project. I talked to the luminous Carla Lind in Dodgeville, a wonderful Wright expert, and she said, well, if those records are anywhere, if those notes of Marlin are anywhere, they're in Taliesin West in Scottsdale. I went down there in a dusty file drawer on a dusty desert on a dusty day when it was 116 in the shade. I was able, in fact, to find, as far as I know, the only copy of those records. That's why I say in research, mimics, mirrors, detective work. That was a good day.
What did they tell you, those records?
Those records told me that, in fact, Julian Carleton said all sorts of things after his arrest, that he ate, in fact, from time to time, sometimes indeed gorged himself, at other times went long periods without eating, but he talked to all kinds of folks. He had not one, not two, but three hearings, if we use the word hearing in its most liberal, broad sense. And when finally confronted by Sheriff Williams, the matter of his guilt seems to have confessed and seems, in fact, to have named as his chief motivation the necessary, in his mind, demise of Emile Brodel.
You argue that the murders may have actually influenced Wright's career from then on as an architect and therefore influence American architecture in general.
Yeah, I think that case can be made. If we look at the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright after the 1914 murders as compared to the sorts of things that he was doing before, we can see a marked difference. The astonishing thing, of course, is after these murders, this is not the end of Frank Lloyd Wright. He's got half of his artistic career in front of him, indeed the more productive half.
And a couple more marriages as well.
One of which at least was equally sad. But a scholar named Twombly has said that Wright's Prairie period ended in 1914 with the death of Mamah Borthwick. I think that case can be made. Starting as early as the next year, his designs began to betray an infinitely more somber worldview. His residential designs, and he was always primarily a residential architect, become, understandably, perhaps, given what had happened on that day, ever more isolated, ever more insular, ever more fortress-like. Built a house for a dentist named Storrs, I recall, and it features a back door but no front door. He had designed, previous to the tragedy, a house for his lawyer, the aforementioned Sherman Booth. And in its original conception, this place was going to be a domestic masterpiece, built in Glencoe, marrying itself organically to the craggy, rolling lakeshore of the place and featuring dramatic horizontal modules. When he finally got around to building it, 1915, 1916, it didn't turn out anything like that. The Booth House is a cube. It's quite isolated. It's obliterated. Oblivious to the powerful possibilities of the land on which it sat. The same can be said for the Millard House in Pasadena, La Minotura, celebrated design. It's made entirely out of textile blocks, not organic at all.
Fireproof?
Fireproof, yes. That's how he sold the Mrs. Millard on the concept.
Taliesin II, what became of that? Burned down?
As with Taliesin I, the residential's part of it at least burned down. This time it seems to have been faulty wiring, perhaps connected to a telephone. Wright was there at that time and did what he could to put it out and stood on the roof with flames all about him, burning away his eyebrows, scorching his feet, but could not save the residential half or wing of the house. He later testified to a docent that he thought it wasn't a bad thing all in all, that implicitly, if not explicitly, God was burning down his houses but leaving his studios intact as a sign that while he disapproved of him as a man, he approved of him as an architect.
William Drennan, thanks for spending this hour with us. Very illuminating hour about Taliesin and what happened there on August 15th, 1914.
What a great pleasure, and thanks to both of you.
You tell a great story.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.